Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we have another amazing Soapbox podcast for you. Our first guest will be talking about the new American Revolution, sustainable activism for the 21st century. And our second guest will give us a perfect example and illustration of why we do need this new American Revolution. I'm very happy and honored to announce that our first guest is Grace Lee Boggs. Grace is almost 99 years old and still going strong. She's a lifelong social activist and feminist. Her newest book is called The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century. And she also is the subject of a recent documentary called American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with the wonderful and persistent Grace Lee Boggs. Grace Lee Boggs, it's an honor to welcome you to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Okay, thank you. I hope you're enjoying your hosting of the show.
Oh, I really am, and it's been almost a year since I rode my bike through Detroit and came to your center. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember.
It was an amazing time. You got to speak to young people who were very interested in your work and your life and what you were doing.
Well, we're trying to create a new post-industrial society, which is the only answer to planetary extinction.
Well, you have that. Actually, Detroit is on the leading edge of that extinction, but also activism for the post-industrial society.
Well, you know, Detroit, where I've lived now for close to 60 years, has been the national and international symbol of the miracles of industrialization. It's also become the national and international symbol of the devastation of deindustrialization. And now it's beginning to appear as the alternative to planetary extinction. So we really have a role to play.
Yes, Detroit was the most interesting in the way of what has happened to Detroit, but also in the activism that you all are doing around these issues. I've spent a weekend there, and I learned a lot from you and from the activists in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Detroit is a wonderful example of how crisis and dilemma and devastation can be creative of innovation. It's an amazing to me to watch how people have been looking at how we can bring the country back into the city, how we can reduce our consumerism, how we can forestall extinction, which has become a real danger.
Right. They say within 15 years, it's possible that human life won't be sustainable anymore.
Well, I think we have to talk a lot more about responsibilities toward life, toward humanity, toward the human race, toward all living things. I think that's where we are on the clock of the world. Do you bring these things up in your campaign for governor?
Oh, I do all the time. We have to do this, I think, try to gain political power, but use the campaign to educate people about these issues.
whether your candidate wins or not, the problems will still be there. And I think the answer is in community organizing like you're doing.
Well, I think community organizing has assumed many different forms. Since I first became a woman organizer 50, 60 years ago, I think we were campaigning much more for our rights in the past.
Right.
Didn't recognize how really disastrous the whole society was, and that our responsibilities were more to the human race and to all living things.
Well, you and your husband, who is now deceased, were part of the Black Liberation Movement. What did you learn about in that struggle?
Well, I think we made a big distinction between rebellion and revolution, and how rebellion is a protest against injustice, but revolution becomes a recognition of responsibility to many, many, many years of civilization.
Today's Jimmy's birthday.
Yes.
Oh. Presente.
My husband, Jimmy,
right,
to whom I was married for 40 years, died 20 years ago.
Right. And tomorrow... That's interesting, because tomorrow would have been my son's 35th birthday, the one who was killed in Iraq, Casey.
Well, I imagine it must mean a very difficult time for you.
It's difficult because Memorial Day and Casey's birthday always coincide. And now Memorial Day, of course, has a special horrible meaning to me, and then Casey's birthday comes up. So yes, it's a hard week, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, life is not easy.
Well, you've lived almost 99 years of it. We were chatting before I recorded the interview that next month will be your 99th birthday, and you're still going strong.
Well, it's something to have been born in the second decade of the 20th century and still have most of your marbles in the second decade of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. You still have all your marbles, too. That's really amazing. Looking back on your years of activism, what do you think is different today than, say, during the 60s when there was a lot of, like you said, struggle for civil rights, struggle for anti-war struggles, and it seemed to me it was much bigger and more militant. What do you see about the struggle back then and the struggle today?
Well, I think militancy in the past had a lot to do with belief that the people in the power structure could do something. And now I think we recognize that not only are they not the solution, but they are the problem.
Is that why you've gone more to your beloved communities?
Say that again?
I'm recognizing that the people in power are part of the problem, not where we should focus on for solutions. Is that why you have transformed into your beloved communities?
Yes, I think so. I think that 50 years ago, the idea that the United States had just won the Second World War and people were thinking that it was a power. Today we can see that it's not only a power, it's a dying power. It's the source of destruction and chaos, and that we are in a very, very different, more profound transformation and transition.
And what is that? Can you expand a little bit on that?
Well, can you just see ourselves as responsible for the extermination of life and of all living things, not only ourselves, but of the only planet we know that has given birth to life? that's a huge responsibility. And so I think we talked less today about rights and more about responsibilities, at least I do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think citizenship has acquired a very much more profound meaning in the last 60 years.
It's acquired a more profound meaning, but I see less people engaged in struggles, not just in struggles, but in forming these communities that we need to overcome this power structure. Do you find that the corporate media is a problem in people being, I think, more complacent?
Well, I don't think it's the corporate media so much as it is, because that is blaming someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to look at ourselves to understand that revolution is transformation of ourselves and not only protest against the existing structures.
Well, we look at what the people, the corporations, the politicians are doing. For example, in California, we have a drought. We're in the middle of a drought. And the government keeps on promoting hydrofracturing or fracking to extract oil, but they keep telling us to use less water. And of course, I think we should always conserve. But one fracking well uses more water in one day than a family of four uses in a year. So how do we, how do we maintain a balance between demanding that practice be ended, but informing people about the practice, and then also conserving energy and resources in our own life?
Well, I think things are happening today that give me a lot of hope. Farmers are beginning to protest against fracking. And students are beginning to demand that their universities divest from fossil fuel industries.
And speaking of divestment, Michigan has a large Arab American population. What do you think about the struggle for Palestinian freedom?
Well, I think that it is finally coming to the forefront for all of us. I think there's a big distinction between Zionism and respect and anti-Semitism.
Right.
The need to identify with the struggle against intolerance.
And there is a growing movement, especially in universities, for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, and it's being successful, but it's also raising these issues.
Well, the young people are coming into the struggle against Zionism, and also against global warming, and I think that's one of the main struggles of today. And how do you, as someone who is contesting for governorship of California, and involve the people in that struggle?
Because I think that you're right. I think this global warming and the degradation of the environment is the most important issue. And Grace, you just like hit the nail on the head, because I don't own a car. I try very hard to leave a small carbon footprint on this earth, and I'm trying to go out to the communities and tell people about fracking and fossil fuel use and how we can demand change from using fossil fuels to clean, renewable, sustainable forms of energy. How can we reduce our own usage of this fossil fuel? But I'm going from community to community by bus, by train, by whatever means I can do this. and I see the freeways just packed with cars. And when you try to tell people to even reduce their use of fossil fuels, they're upset about what's happening, but they don't want to change their own lives to alleviate the problem.
Well, I think one of the most important things for us to reveal and help people understand is that revolution is not just for transformation of institutions, for the transformation of ourselves, that we are part of the problem. And we can only become part of the solution when we change ourselves.
Well, absolutely. I was at a debate at a college, and I said that we have to reduce our... We have to get out of our cars. We have to park our cars. And parking your car isn't just good for the environment, it's good for yourself. And I actually got booed.
Well, I'm glad you're saying that. That's certainly true.
And we have to say it. I don't care about getting booed. But, you know, we see some young people who are really engaged in trying to change themselves and change society, but then we see others who don't want to do anything but conform and be part of that destructive society. But speaking of the young people, what do you think about the Occupy movement?
Well, I think the Occupy movement was the beginning of mobilization, which is part of developing a revolutionary situation. And I think that's the time that we are in the part of the world. And I think people don't understand that a revolution is not just a protest. It's an extension of our humanity. It's a continuation of a struggle that's been going on for millions of years to become more human.
Right. And when people think of revolution, a lot of people think of violence and disorder, but revolution can actually bring more order. Can you talk about how we could do that?
Well, I think that's one of the struggles we're carrying on today. I don't know whether you've seen the film of me, the documentary, but I have watched people viewing it, and they have thanked me for the film, because most people think of revolution only in terms of taking over the state and we've seen what has happened with that. And to have another, to know that we have to have a revolution that is the evolution of our humanity is a great revelation. And people need to make that big shift, that leap in their thinking of revolution is evolution.
Well, in the beloved communities is about this revolution of values.
That's right.
About capitalist values and really capitalist values versus human values. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think this week in particular, when the people have been talking a lot about Martin Luther King's anti-Vietnam War speech, he called for a revolution not only against racism, but against materialism and militarism. And this is a great opportunity to talk about that kind of revolution.
Can you talk about that kind of revolution when we live? I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. gave that speech in 1967, and to me, we live in an even more materialistic society where we are not called citizens anymore, we're called consumers.
That's right. I mean, we thought of consumerism as liberation, and now we see that it's a kind of poisoning of the environment.
How do we, in this materialistic, consumeristic society, transform into people who do have this revolution of values? We just see, and really nothing has changed. I think things have just gotten worse, where our young people go into lifelong debt. They become debt slaves. So they have to become wage slaves. And, of course, we're bombarded with these messages that we have to own these things. And if we don't own these things, we're not quite good enough Americans.
Well, I think that being not American in the sense of not being a consumer is probably a blessing.
Yes.
Have you read my latest book, Next American Revolution?
I have it. You gave it to me when I was in Detroit. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but it is definitely on my pile, my list of reading. And when we do our soapbox newsletter, we're going to put the links to your movie and to your book and anything else that you want us to link to give people information. Because, Grace, I think what you are talking about is the way that we need to be going. And a couple years ago, I started this action called Recreating Revolutionary Communities. And as soon as my election is over, I'm going to dive right back into that, because for the past year, it's all been about this election.
The University of California Press has published a book called The Next American Revolution. And the first chapter is entitled, These Are the Times to Grow Our Souls. And you can get a copy of that first chapter by writing to the University of California Press in Berkeley online. These are the times to grow our souls and stop growing our wallets and our garages.
And I'm not so sure anymore that we are growing our wallets. I think we're shrinking our wallets by participating in materialism.
Yeah, but we still want to. We aim to grow our wallets. And we're disappointed when they shrink.
Right. Well, the 1% are growing their bank accounts, and we're actually getting poorer. What do you think about this so-called richest country in the world having the greatest income inequality?
Well, Cindy, so many fundamental changes are involved. We have to stop thinking of the earth as a commodity and think of it as something that is part of us and we are part of. The transformation in our values, in our thinking, in our hearts and in our souls and in our communities is so profound. And it's such a privilege to be living at this time and be proud of that transformation.
Grace, where were you born?
I was born on June 27, 1915.
In where?
I was born about my father's Chinese restaurant in Providence, Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
My mother did not know how to read or write because there were no schools for females in her little Chinese village.
But you went to university, which was quite revolutionary for itself at the time you went.
Well, I came from a middle-class family. I had the great opportunity to be the first one in my family to go to college and to learn to think historically and to understand that we are not only guts, but minds and souls.
Well, what's going on around the world is definitely definitely concerning, but do you believe in that old adage, think globally but act locally?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Think globally but act locally.
She was asking if you believe in the whole notion of global and working locally.
Well, I think you're on the West Coast, and on the West Coast they think a lot about the Far East. And I was recently on the West Coast for a screening of the film of my life. And I think there is a lot of promise there in the Asian American community to think about deeply. In fact, I think I'm amazed at the role that Asian Americans are beginning to play in American life.
Well, definitely in California, it does seem like they are getting more prominent politically, and so it's for political power. You also need people power, so that's you're exactly right. And I believe you had a screening of your movie in Los Angeles. But that was when I was still on my bike ride, or I would have loved to come and, support you in that.
Well, when I was growing up, we were so few and far between that we were practically invisible. And we have become very visible on many college campuses, as much as 30% to 40% of the student body will be Asian American these days, or are Asian Americans. And when I went to college, for example, there were only 2 Asian Americans on campus, myself and a friend of mine. And things have changed remarkably, and the world is changing.
Well, California has an appalling history in regards to especially our Chinese immigrants. And so it is nice that they persevered and are able to rise above the horrible treatment they had, especially here in California.
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's very difficult to anticipate what the future will bring. But that change from the past when we were almost invisible to the present, where we are beginning to make some difference or begin to be prominent to some degree, does mean that the changes are taking place and the world is becoming more and more one world.
Well, definitely. Grace Lee Boggs, we are running out of time. Do you have a website that you'd like to tell my listeners about? But I will provide those links on my newsletter.
Well, the website is bogcenter.org.
BoggsCenter.org.
And the book that I would urge people to read is The Next American Revolution, and to write to the University of California Press in Berkeley to ask for an online first chapter.
Great, and I will provide those links, like I said. Grace Lee Boggs, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and an early happy birthday to you for your 99th birthday in June.
Good health, good luck to you.
Our next guest on the Soapbox is Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. Mara is a D.C.-based attorney, and she is the director for the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, it's great to have you on. And like we were chatting a bit before, it's been a long time since we've spoken, but you've been extremely busy.
tracking down the surveillance state, yes.
So you have an organization called Partnership for Civil Justice?
That's right. I'm the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund.
And just a bit, tell my listeners about the PCJ.
Well, we're a civil rights organization, a nonprofit. We litigate constitutional rights cases. We do a lot of government transparency work. We do a lot of education and outreach on critical civil liberties, civil rights issues. And as you know, Cindy, we do a lot of work with the movement in the United States representing demonstrators and protesters and people who want to be able to use the streets, the sidewalks, the parkland to be able to express a point of view and advocate for social change.
Oh, absolutely. I know you have, just to me, your organization and you have been a tremendous help in our various activities, especially in Washington, D.C., but you also, your organization, like, won a historic case not too long ago. Can you tell my listeners a little bit about that?
I'm not sure which you're referring to, but we...
The protesters in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we've litigated a number of mass arrest cases, including here in Washington, D.C., and in two of the cases that we brought, it involved more than 1,000 people that were peacefully protesting, were trapped, detained, mass arrested by the D.C. police, in some cases working with federal law enforcement authorities. They were taken to a gym. They were hogtied wrist to ankle. And in the course of litigating these cases that went on for a decade, we found extremist conduct, in addition to the mass arrest, in terms of a cover-up by law enforcement in Washington, what appeared to be tampering with evidence, loss and destruction of key evidence. And in the end, we were able to successfully win those cases by getting not only very large settlements, the largest settlements in U.S. history for protesters in D.C., totaling more than $22 million. But what we felt was very critical is we were able to completely change the policies in D.C. in terms of how the police handle demonstrations. And as one federal judge said, it was that the settlements were historic, a benefit for future generations. And we really took that to heart because our view is that, you know, this is the nation's capital. This is where people come. This is where you come, Cindy, time and time again. And people have the right to be able to speak out, to protest at the White House, at Congress, and not be subject to arrest and to threats of arrest and to criminalization merely because they're engaged in the First Amendment activities.
Well, not just like arrest, but really unnecessarily harsh treatment by the police for doing something we think is just our right, as you said. But the reason I reached out to you,
Cindy, I've lost you.
Uh-oh.
All right, now I hear you.
Okay. That was weird. Do you hear me now?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay. But the reason that I reached out to you this time is because your organization has done a lot of work around fusion centers and the fusion centers and their massive spying on Occupy movement. But tell my listeners a little bit about the fusion centers and what they're supposed to be doing and why they exist.
Well, after September 11th, there was a massive reorganization of intelligence and law enforcement domestically in the United States and the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. And the idea was, as it was told to the American people who are opening their wallets in terms of, well, not willingly, spending billions of dollars of taxpayer funds, is that these new structures are necessary to protect the population from the threat of catastrophic violence. And as part of this, there's the creation of the fusion centers. Now, fusion centers are established on a local, state, and regional level. They are they involve law enforcement from federal, from local, from what we're seeing now, private contractors. And it's supposed to be, in terms of the word fusion, the fusion of all the intelligence information coming together through all the different law enforcement entries so that they can assess and look for what they say are terrorist threats. But people have been very concerned about fusion centers for quite some time because they are really unmonitored kind of cesspools of collection of information that is goes well beyond anything that anyone could even rationally claim had anything to do with a terrorist threat, to just suspicious activity reporting, collections on information of people in terms of their religious activities and associations, their free speech activities and associations. And it's been a very hard fight because it's very hard to get any information on really what fusion centers do, what their internal documents look like. The DHS just doesn't hand them over. Even in 2012, the U.S. Senate did a major investigation into fusion centers. They had limited access to materials, but the Senate report, which was bipartisan in terms of being both the Democrats and the Republicans, that report condemned the fusion centers as being completely wasteful, as not pursuing or preventing any terrorist attacks. And now the documents that we have really show what fusion centers are doing.
Yeah, talk about that, the link between the fusion centers and the Occupy movement. And an additional question that goes with that is, besides the massive spying on the Occupy movement, is there any evidence of any plans to subvert it or co-opt it in what you found out?
Well, the documents that we got, we have about 4,000 pages of documents that are involving intelligence officials, fusion center officials, communications back and forth. These documents, we think these documents are, you know, really a tip of an iceberg. There would be a lot more that exists. But even what we have is a window in, a pulls back the curtain on fusion centers such that we've never been able to see before. And these documents show fusion center focus on the Occupy movement. It's part of a comprehensive effort we undertook when the crackdown started against Occupy in the fall of 2011, and we began doing public records, Freedom of Information Act demands to federal agencies, local police agencies all over the country, and trying to get out information related to coordination in suppression of Occupy. And over the last 2 years, we've continued that investigation. We've been fighting to get materials out. We've been analyzing the tens of thousands of pages that we've gotten. This set has more information on fusion centers than I've seen existing anywhere in the public domain. And it allows us to see that the fusion centers, far from carrying out what their claimed authority is, which is counterterrorism, you know, authority trying to stop catastrophic violence, was focused on the most peaceful protests in the United States. They were reporting, monitoring, cataloging all manner of activity by the Occupy movement. The Fusion Center documents we have also show the Pentagon and the military engaged in partnering with the fusion centers, including reports and information being pushed through fusion centers with the DTRA, the military's Defense Threat Reduction Agency, an entity that is tasked with finding weapons of mass destruction around the world, is actually spending time focused on Occupy here in the United States. We have documents that show the Boston Regional Intelligence Center, about 1,200 pages that we got of these reports that they were putting out twice a day, focused on Occupy Boston, on every minor and major event that they did, from teach-ins, educational forums, yoga classes, what students were organizing on what campus and thinking about whether they would come down to Occupy, reporting on colleges, on activists. And it's noteworthy that this massive amount of resources devoted to reporting and cataloging Occupy and surveilling it was taking place exactly in the time period that the planning would have been going on for the Boston Marathon bombing. But that's what the Boston Regional Intelligence Center was focused on. Its resources, its anti-terrorism authority, all turned to Occupy.
Well, and exactly, that was my next question. With all of this spying in Boston, the police state was too busy spying on peaceful protesters to actually come up with any intelligence about the Sarnoff brothers, but there's been some really actual, there's been actual proof that they did have some link to the police state, the alleged bombers, the alleged Boston Marathon bombers.
Yeah, that's not information that I have, but, you know, I think it's very noteworthy that you have, you know, as you said, I mean, the police state is turning to look at Occupy, and yet, you know, you have these other activities that are going on simultaneously. And when you look at the documents, I mean, it's really a huge devotion of resources. The Boston Regional Intelligence Center, the fusion center for that area, is actually monitoring people's Twitter feeds, their Facebook pages. They're writing down, you know, 27 people on a Facebook page have RSVP'd for some educational teach-in, and then, you know, 12 hours later, it's grown to 38 people have RSVP'd for an educational teach-in. I mean, I think it's very defining. And, you know, another document that we have that is very interesting and reflects a lot of what we saw is there was an extreme focus among fusion centers and intelligence officials on whether or not there would be a Black Friday boycott in 2011 that would affect retail sales.
Right.
Now, I just don't see how anyone can credibly suggest that, you know, a, quote, threat to people spending money and affecting retail sales on Black Friday can legitimately fall under any anti-terrorism, anti-criminal authority. And yet, they partnered with the International Association of Retail Centers, a shopping center trade industry group, which itself put together a 30-page report tracking Occupy, pulling together what they called potential threats, which included things like people demanding that you buy local or not shop on Black Friday.
Wow.
And this got circulated to intelligence officials, Interfusion Center. We have a commander talking about, an intelligence director talking about how he wants a product built off of that to let all of his district commanders know about the potential threat, the threat of not purchasing.
This is amazing, and especially, I mean, I don't want to gloss over what happened in Boston, but because to me that is super significant, and that should be like front page news in every newspaper or a leading story on every news agency that the police state was spying on peaceful protesters while people were planning on bombing a marathon, whatever happened there. That's just incredible to me. And Mara, you were talking about they're reading Twitter feeds and Facebook pages. I've had Washington PD or Park Police call me because of something they saw on my Facebook page. Or once we were planning a protest in front of Dime Court in Washington, D.C., and their head of security called me on my private cell phone that I don't give out that information. So yeah, it's like, and they want to know exactly what you're going to do, where you're going to be, are you planning on any civil disobedience and things like that. And of course, I don't answer their questions. So it seems like this stuff is just like, I'm not surprised because, you know, I know the depths that our empire can go to, but we really need, you know, more, we really need to get this information out to more people.
Well, I would urge your listeners to come to our website, bigbrotheramerica.org. We set up a specific site that's housing all these documents. And you can join the campaign to end the fusion centers. We are demanding and encouraging people to demand that they be defunded. We just think there is no legitimate basis. These documents really show what these fusion centers are doing, how they're, you know, one, massively violating civil rights and civil liberties in the United States, but two, a gigantic waste of millions and millions of dollars of money. I mean, we know it's in the hundreds of millions. It's probably in the billions, but interestingly enough, Department of Homeland Security wouldn't even give a hard number to the U.S. Senate when the Senate was doing an investigation, claiming that they couldn't really keep track because of the different funding streams they used to fund fusion centers. And, you know, you look around this country and the desperate need for jobs, you know, the desperate need for schools to have better facilities, you know, the fact that people are just can't afford to go to a doctor, even with Obamacare, it's having, you know, a huge impact still on so many people who just can't afford their medical bills, and yet there's endless, endless money for domestic surveillance, for war, and, you know, we have the ability to stand up and to say, when you have something like this and you have these documents and it shows what they're doing, to directly demand of elected representatives that they defund the fusion center. So we do urge people to come to BigBrotherAmerica.org and take action.
And I will be posting the links to your reports and everything on the newsletter when we send this out. But I did have a question that wasn't, I don't think, answered. Did you see any evidence of planning to co-opt or subvert the Occupy movement in all this massive spying?
So, yeah, I'm starting to answer that because the issue of the tip of the iceberg is that we don't think that what we have is necessarily the comprehensive view. Like, at the level at which I think you would have more visibility as to those kind of activities, we don't have something that's showing, for example, wiretapping, but nor would I expect that to show up in here. We do have some documents that would indicate certainly undercover infiltration at different levels. And you can see, for example, one document, and I think it's notable particularly in the context of the crackdown. You know, when the crackdown happened, all the law enforcement agencies were indicating that these were all just sort of isolated events and individual reactions to Occupy, you know, in different cities and towns, although they were coming in quick succession.
Right.
But what we have, for example, is the Major City Police Chiefs Association created what they called an Emerging Issues Subcommittee. And this is a national association all around the country, police chiefs and law enforcement personnel. And that committee decided that they were going to be looking at major threats in the United States. And the, quote, first order of business was Occupy. And then what they did is they directed the Southern Nevada Counterterrorism Center, which is one of the mass terrorism fusions, counterterrorism fusion centers in the United States, to put together a twice-weekly product analysis on Occupy that then was circulated and sent out to fusion centers, virtually every fusion center in the United States. So here you have all of the police chiefs, most of the police chiefs and major police officials throughout the United States working hand-in-hand with the fusion centers and all putting their sights on Occupy. And the documents we have show the distribution list. So the documents are interesting because they're virtually unredacted. So there's a lot of data and metadata that's available in them.
4,000 pages, the tip of the iceberg. And also, I think when I was reading your report, one of the quotes was something like, I'm going to go down to Occupy and listen to some tunes and get a piece of ass or something like that.
Let's go down to Occupy and get laid.
Yeah,
and I'm going as a protester for Halloween. So these are communications between a fusion center, DC fusion center official, and a Baltimore fusion center counterterrorism official on their official time, on their official emails. It's one email we have where they're having an exchange about going down to the Occupy protest in Baltimore listen to some tunes and get laid, and then they're joking about, or not joking about, dressing up as Occupy protesters. One of them is saying he's dressing up as an Occupy protester for Halloween and going to the Annapolis and Baltimore Occupy sites and our Halloween events. And you know, the fact that they talk like that and that they believe that they have the authority and that it's a proper use of, you know, time and money and just the contempt for lawful free speech, organizing, and associational activity. I mean, these are officials with access to and positions in association with fusion centers in the United States.
Well, and also, very quickly, because we are running out of time, I just recently read that Mayor Gene Kwan of Oakland was actually on the phone with other mayors trying to figure out what to do with Occupy when her police force was violently cracking down on Occupy Oakland.
She was, and actually that came out during the crackdown, and it was very interesting because she let slip that she had been on these coordinating calls with the Conference of Mayors around the country. And then people downplay that, people as in the Conference of Mayors and other mayors' offices. But actually in the documents that we obtained, not in this set, there's a bunch in this set.
Mm-hmm.
But in other documents we have, because we have thousands and thousands of pages of last year's, all of which we've made available on our website for searching, we can see the emails going back and forth among the Conference of Mayors and the different cities talking about how to deal with Occupy. And how they're approached to Occupy. And they set up regularly scheduled calls. So this movement that really took fire in the United States and really caught people's imaginations as a social justice movement and a potential vehicle for social change was really of deep concern to the mayors and the police chiefs and the intelligence apparatus in the United States. And I think that's really a critical takeaway in addition to the fact that the Fusion Center should be defunded because of their improper activities. It says something else, too, about the social justice movement in the United States. I mean, here you have Occupy. It's a peaceful movement. It's setting up camp. And all the sites of the U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies, this massive apparatus in the United States, turns its attention completely to this social justice movement. Now, I don't think you can find these documents at the Tea Party or anything like that. It's about people organizing for change. And that's really what they cared about. That's really what they were concerned about.
And people, you know, like you said, they can't say it about the Tea Party. Some Tea Party events, people actually brought guns to. And they weren't, like, as oppressed as our peaceful protests were.
Well, of course, I mean, or just recently at Bundy, I mean, you can have this guy, like, taking over federal land with a whole bunch of people and bringing guns, and you think about the demonstrations around the country that you participated in and that others participated in, and people having peaceful protests in the streets and the sidewalks and, you know, and being subject to brutality and mass arrests. None of them were carrying guns. I mean, can you imagine if the anti-war movement ever did anything like that, which is not what their orientation was,
right.
But... yeah, you can have a right-wing movement do that, and they just don't get shut down.
Well, Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And like I said, I will post all those links. And you have gotten some significant coverage in the corporate media about this. Has there been any kind of response or energy around that?
We're getting a lot of people who are coming and joining the campaign to end the fusion centers. And it's interesting because this issue really crosses a lot of political lines in terms of people in the United States and with differing political perspectives, but agreeing that they don't believe this is what government intelligence agencies should be doing. And that we think is very significant, too. But we're very heartened by the extreme public response, the positive public response to a campaign to end the fusion center. So we're excited about those steps and that action.
Well, Mara, thank you again for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and thank you for everything you do, and I hope we talk again sooner than years.
I hope so, too, Cindy. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, Mara. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's another show. That's another Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I hope, as always, that you learned something and you are inspired and motivated to do something. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller, my assistant producer, Mikey, my guests, Grace Lee Boggs and Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, and you especially for listening and supporting the show. And please do support the show if you are able. Go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com and donate whatever you can. And if you can't donate, the show is provided out of love for free. So please spread the news. Send this link out to your friends and colleagues out there on the interwebs. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.